Penrose graphical calculus for tensor network states. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to kind of go back to the beginning of how a lot of this stuff started. And it's a story with many different hats. And I'm going to kind of show a certain line of motivation and how kind of people came at it from a different direction. At least I'm going to try to. And I'm going to show how everything's sort of coming together and why it's an exciting time to think about these sort of things right now. And to get going, I have a long list of current collaborators. And I'll mention more of them as we go along and we talk about little bits of it. And so one of the reasons I ended up staying here for so long is because after I came here, I ended up with more collaborators. So when you get more collaborators, you have to have, you get more projects, then you have to stay here and finish it off. And so there's a pile of things that we're working on, and this stuff will be finished by New Year. And we'll go through and give an overview now. So the idea is that we want to have unification. So in physics, physicists understand this very well. They like to unify things. Okay, so bringing things together and talking about things in the same framework, same footing, is advantageous for many different reasons. Okay, you can adapt techniques across problem domains. You can cast, apart from just software, you can cast mathematical proofs that you found for one thing. You can bring that over to something else and say, well, what does it mean in this scenario? So what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk about these things which seem very disjoint, okay, maybe partially related. Then I'm going to talk about how we're working towards relating these more and more, and what are some of the results we had, what are some of the results we're trying for, and what we hope to accomplish by doing this. Can everybody see that okay? Should we work on the lights a bit?
You could turn those front lights off, my time.
Yeah. I'm not sure. I'm not sure I actually can turn. Okay. It's the eye in the sky, right? So. How's that? Is that a bit better? Okay, good. Okay, so quantum circuits, and I do imagine that you're all familiar with these, and why were they important, and why are they important? So the world is going on, quantum mechanics is as it was, and some people came along and said, well, actually, quantum mechanics is important for computer science, okay? And this happened in the early 80s. And they originally had this thing called the quantum Turing machine model, which is a bit cumbersome. And I'm not sure who was the first person. I believe it was David Deutsch. That was part of his, I think he got a Turing award. And one of it was to do with universal models of computing with these circuits. And I think he's one of the first people to use these quantum circuits. And the quantum circuits were very, very important. It lets you talk about the Oracle model. It lets you prove complexity bounds. It lets you reason about things. How many people have worked on circuits? I imagine some people in here have worked on it or you've learned it in a quantum computing course. And you'll find that it is, in many cases, better than thinking about evolution induced by a Hamiltonian. Okay, so you can think of this as a propagator and it has a graphical picture. And an example of that is now quantum circuits have a shortcoming. Well, what I would consider a shortcoming. And so one of the shortcomings is they sort of go backwards. You see, you wouldn't write the equation that way. You'd write the equation one way, then you flip everything, and you'd draw it out. But this is a too big of a shortcoming. Now, these are some very common circuits. And this circuit here, this is one to simulate part of a Hamiltonian for an H2 molecule. Right? And at the very end of the talk, because this was supposed to be a quantum computing organized event, so I was going to talk about this thing that I call benchmark for species, and maybe we can all be involved in that in some fashion. And it's going to have a little bit to do with this, but that'll come at the very end. So this is a quantum circuit. These are both quantum circuits, and this was going on for some time. Now, I want to mention this because I get questions about this sometimes. And I normally don't get questions about this by people that are really actively working on the subject, but people often ask me, they say, well, I want a quantum programming language, okay? And then I say, well, you're trying to program something that is inherently 2D. You're trying to program interactions in a plane. So maybe the programming language isn't the kind of language, maybe there's a bit of a breakdown by just the 1D nature of text. So maybe you need something a little bit more than that. And so I think that the quantum programming language is actually quantum circuits, and more generally, these tensor networks. Quantum circuits allow us to study things. They allow us to gain conceptual understanding by restricting the type of circuits that we consider. Okay, these are basically toy models. These are what other areas of physics would call the toy theories. People in foundations now are working a lot on this and pushing these ideas further. So the gate families that people are going to be the most familiar with would be match gates, which have a certain type of restriction on the gate. It's a two-body gate, and a certain type of restriction on how they can be placed. And these types of gates are efficient to simulate, and as are stabilizer gates. There's rewrite rules, and these are gate identities, and physicists would actually consider those to be symmetries, stated in kind of the way that we think about things. And now we'll talk about classical circuits. So just to kind of remind you what's going on, I'm just kind of reviewing all these different pieces, then we're going to sort of tie them together and make our best attempt at uniting them. And so the classical circuits, everyone should be familiar with those. Now, we're not going to talk about, it's actually a bit too close, I'm going to move this down. So hopefully you can still hear me. Check cash credit, should be good. He'll flash the lights if not. So the circuits we're going to talk about are not clocked circuits. We're not going to talk about automata. We're going to talk about circuits that don't have clocks, okay? And classical circuits have been studied to great detail. They're everywhere around us, okay? Classical logic, Boolean logic. People should be familiar with those things already, and I expect people have actually worked on it to some level. And there's maybe some bits that are a bit more technical and kind of more field specific would be the elegant decomposition methods, where they take a Boolean function and they factor this using techniques, and you get structures out that look like butterflies or trees or something else. And a lot of that stuff is very interesting, and it's inspirational in the sense that now we can think about what would be the quantum analog of those techniques in the tensor network realm. And I think some people that have invented, Mera or tree tensor networks or other types of structures, they basically have invented very general methods that are kind of quantized versions of that, like kind of the quantum theory of decomposition would be one way to look at it. So we'll come to that a bit more later on. Just to give an idea of how to read one of these circuits for people that are not familiar, is you have Boolean variables. This is a copy. So this variable will go both directions. And this is a gate, which is XOR. This is an AND gate. And so that's an adder circuit. You also can have rewrite laws, where you can take an algebraic relationship, like De Morgan's law, and you can express it graphically. Okay, so if I say let's consider a quantum computer, a quantum device, and let's consider classical circuits on that device, okay, then people are going to say that the type of classical circuit that is a quantum classical circuit, or vice versa, is given precisely by reversible circuits. And so people study this, dating back to Fredkin, to Foley, Feynman himself, there's a gate named after him. So they studied these machines that don't dissipate heat. And these are reversible computers, and then people factored this double-controlled NOT gate. They factored it into structures like this, and each one of those, in turn, you can model using a Hamiltonian evolution, as long as you can sequence it and time it. So you can create yourself, using your favorite quantum computing technology, these classical gates, and they received a lot of interest and a lot of study, and there's still ongoing work related to those and also reversible computing models. Okay, so now tensor network states. Now, I do expect that everyone is actually more familiar with tensor network states than they were before you had an army of tensor network people basically show up at PI, which I think is great. That's one of the reasons why I'm here. So everybody that I'm mentioning on the slide is actually here, and I suspect there's more on the way. And tensor network states These are cool. These are ways to understand many-body physics. These are ways to understand Hamiltonians. And it's more than just a way to kind of unite a lot of ideas. These things have practical applications, and they're surpassing pre-existing limitations in technology. They're able to do everything that you could do with DMRG and a lot of other techniques like Monte Carlo. It fits into this framework very well, but you can do things that are different. And there's certain, you know, I've gotten to a lot of discussions with people that are from the artificial intelligence community who say, well, this is just PCA. It's not. You know, matrix product states are not PCA, principal component analysis. It's different. Matrix product states have recursive factorization. And so if people want to talk about the differences between some of the artificial intelligence techniques and what is going on with the data compression of these, I'm actually very interested in that. So I'd love to talk about that sort of thing. For people that want background, this is Rob's. Rob has a set of four lectures, which are on the PI website. And there's review articles. Actually, Vidal has another one, which is called Geometry and Tensor Networks, which is a pretty good read. So there's a lot of material available. the standard structure that people have dealt with today would be this, kind of like this caterpillar, I guess. And mathematicians, at one point, they called them tensor trains. They don't do the same thing with them. So everybody's named this sort of thing something different. But the people who did it the best are basically people in quantum information science. So what they had is these ideas of area laws and other things, and it kind of explained a lot of the things that people knew about in terms of how these models behave. And going past limitations in area laws, people started looking at these types of networks, which can represent longer range correlations. And then the 2D cases, this one's typically called PEPs, and this is some kind of a 2D tensor tree. Now, this is the AKLT model, and you might be thinking, what the heck is that? And I kind of agree. So this is, I don't like this notation. But what they're thinking is, you have a bunch of singlets here, and so you can think of those as being having legs going out, and then they apply a projection onto all of those. And so that's one that you'll see quite a bit for people that study that model, and it has relevance for quantum computing, measurement-based quantum computing. Now, these are classical spin models, and classical spin models living on a 2D lattice. You have spins on for every dot, and you can have some kind of coupling across the spins. And the Hamiltonian is some form that looks like this. And you can look at these in many different ways. You can think of them as, for certain scenarios, you can think of them as string nets or some other type of model like that. Now, we'll talk about Penrose tensor networks. And he wasn't thinking about how to use these for data compression for algorithms or how to simulate many-body physics. He was thinking about mostly about relativity, but he also did work on quantum mechanics and reasoning about quantum mechanics, which is quite interesting. And he has an algorithm in 1971, and I won't have time to talk about that today, but some people will be thinking that that's interesting, and I can talk about that later, or maybe at the end if we have time. Now, here's what he was thinking. So, very visual guy. He did a lot of stuff with geometry, and during his PhD, he apparently came up with a way to reason kind of on his own. So he did a PhD on tensor analysis. And he did a bunch of different things with tensors. And so what he did is he started drawing pictures for them, apparently. And he didn't really show anyone. Okay, so he didn't consider that to be that important at the time. But he kept using it and refining it. And then later on, he said, oh, well, you know, maybe I should actually not hide it. I should actually show it. And he decided to do that in the late 60s and early 70s and made a few very well-known and important contributions that are important in certain areas, but maybe less known in other areas. And so what he was thinking was he takes a tensor with three indices, A, B, and C, and he draws it as a picture in effectively an evident manner. So upper indices get upper legs, lower indices get lower legs. Likewise for this one, get that tensor. Now, it's irritating to write equations. It gets very irritating very fast to write equations like this. So Mukesh, for instance, I've seen one of your papers where you have all the graphical stuff, but you put in an equation just to kind of warn people, you know, don't go there. And it doesn't take very much. We're talking half a dozen tensors. You contract them up, and maybe you can write it. Sure, that's fine. You won't want to write it. But to reason with it, you really can't do that. So to do something like this, this is drawn by Penrose. I actually took it out of the PDF and put him in here. So this is he did a lot of drawing and all of his work, if you're not familiar with that. And a lot of it's very good. So to manipulate, just to go from here to here, it's kind of a conceptual thing. I don't know what that necessarily means, but you can kind of get the idea that you can look at these in a way where it kind of reveals a little bit of hidden structure that you might not actually get out of the equation. And so this became quite important. So the words for all of this are different now. People have studied this quite a bit, and they've renamed everything. He called it an abstract tensor system, which I actually think is it's a very good name. It has a utilitarian kind of feel to it. So it's abstract, and it's tensors, and it's a system. And that's kind of, I think it's maybe a lot of it actually. So I'll tell you something, the story about how this paper kind of entered into what I'm doing and how it's been quite influential. I was about ready to hit the airport, and I realized that it was my turn to do the journal club. So I decided to pick a paper which I already knew everything in, you know, quote, unquote. And the reason I picked this one is because I read some more modern work, which I thought captured everything in there. But as I went through it, I found there was actually quite a bit in there that didn't really, not all of it was reflected in the modern work. People had different takes on it, and they only did little bits of it. But as I read this paper, I realized there was actually quite a bit more, and I found that he had an algorithm in there and a whole lot of other things. And so this is kind of his theoretical bit here, which says how to raise and lower indices. Okay, and here's what he introduced. And these are quite important. So in the tensor language, everything's going to be directed. Okay, everything's going to have inputs and outputs. But here he emphasizes that he can turn arms into legs and vice versa. So he says that really inputs and outputs in a lot of cases are really just completely equivalent. Okay, and we can see that in different scenarios arising in physics. I think some people that are working on foundations of physics have worked on these types of things and looked at dualities and other types of things. So if you bend a wire, then you bend it back, it's the same as doing nothing. So if you raise a tensor, then lower it, it's the same as doing nothing. Now, he defined these two tensors. This is the anti-symmetric tensor. Each of the Hilbert spaces are three dimensions. It's like Q-trits, if you will, since it's supposed to be a quantum computing conference. this is your delta. And he defined what I think is the first graphical rewrite system, where you can take a tensor contraction, and you can have graphical identities, and you can simplify it just based on the graphical identities. And if you believe all the graphical identities, then you believe all of the rules that you can derive from them. Okay, so this led to graphical depictions of formal logic, language, information processing, things like that. So it's quite powerful stuff. So this is a fully contracted epsilon tensor, gives 6. Etc. You'll see here there's 3 legs up on all of these, and he sums over them. So 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, etc. Okay, so it's quite interesting. Now here's some of the stuff he's done on quantum mechanics. Okay, so states, triangles, co-states, could be a triangle or a circle. States could also be a circle. Different, instead of putting a symbol inside of it, he might draw a triangle or a circle. There's a mirror here. When you reflect it, that's the conjugate transpose. So everything is very directed. So how would I just do the transpose I would just, in his notation, this is going to be psi. Now, if I just do the transpose, I'll just bend that wire up, okay? Now, that's not necessarily the same as this, you see, because this is actually the dagger. So if that's a complex vector, then that'll take the transpose and the conjugate. And this is interesting. So he has a bipartite quantum state here, and he shows that if you trace one of these off, you end up with this type of structure. So we'll return to that later. And I think it's quite interesting and maybe related to some of the things that people are thinking about now. The graphical trace is done by connecting open wires to closed loops. And, of course, there's the inner product. Okay, so category theory. Category theory is a lot of things. It kind of has a strange reputation. A lot of different people work on it. Some pure mathematicians think it's too pure. Some applied mathematicians hate it. Some applied mathematicians love it. Like, people that design programming languages use this quite a bit. And people that are doing stuff with formal logic, reasoning, things like that, they actually work on this quite a bit. People that are working on topology, people that are trying to unify mathematics, it's been present in some branches of physics more than others. So the beauty of it is that, well, what I consider the beauty of it, and it's a hard piece of mathematics, so to go through it, it takes a little bit of time. So there's an entrance fee, but I think it's kind of worth it, at least to understand some of the basics of it. And John Bates has a couple of tutorials which are actually very well written, and this is how I originally learned about this stuff. And it's pretty well written, and they're designed for physicists or people that are not category theorists, because category theorists actually consider themselves even different than mathematicians, because it's not really part of the it's very modern mathematics, so it's not part of the standard curriculum. It's very abstract, and it's interesting. So your definitions can be expressed very, very precisely. And once you understand category theory, you can communicate with someone doing programming languages or someone doing something else in a very easy way, and it's important. That's very important for science. The difficulty is that all the words mean something, and the words don't really mean something until you know what they mean. And so that's kind of the difficulty. But once you know it, it becomes easy, it becomes unifying. So there's been work on applying it to physics. In 1995, the dagger compact categories, which define finite dimensional quantum mechanics, were defined by Bates and Dolan. And a lot of people carried on work in different directions based on that. Some of the stuff that was influential for me, and after this, this stuff blew up and a lot of people worked on it. So stuff that was influential for me was a lot of work by Lafont. And he was really thinking about, defining a tensor system and expressing everything in terms of relations that are purely diagrammatic. And so these are the kind of things that Lafont did. This is right out of his paper, actually, mentioned here. So he calls it Penrose diagrams in two-dimensional rewriting, and it's an applications of categories in computer science journal or book or whatever that is. And all of these can kind of mean, all of these mean something that could be an equation. And for instance, let's talk about this right here. So if you take two things and you pair them into one, what is an operation that does that? Addition does that. You take two numbers and you add them and you get one number. Okay? So addition has a unit, which is zero. So if I add anything to zero, I just get whatever happened. So that's kind of how this stuff works. So this is now looking at it not really like tensors, but looking at it as a way to reason about equations. So and as we go along, because it's a smaller audience than normal today, a lot of people are on vacation, just feel free to, you know, interrupt me, and if I can answer the question, I will, and if not, I'll try to figure it out and tell you later. Okay, so the importance here is that he's using these diagrams in two directions now. So you can look at them. Is information going in this way or going in this way? Okay, which makes sense for tensors, but for mathematics, actually, you ended up going from algebra, which are pairings, to co-algebra, which are co-pairings. And so this is important for that. And this, I'm just kind of illustrating, you know, to give everybody an idea of what you could do with it. And, okay, so a lot of different people grabbed a hold of this stuff and did a lot of different things. And everything from talking about topological field theory, Feynman diagrams, you know, really talking about morphisms, linear maps, all that stuff. Good references, very good read. This book, this is more of a reference book. This is free on the internet, so it's also a very good read. Okay, so the network models that we talked about, well, they're all networks, so that's good. So we probably could unify them somehow. And how can we relate them? So we'll go back and we'll do the overview again, but we'll start talking about the connections this time and how these things can connect to each other. All right, so let's start off with those spin models. Okay, so spin models, what we'll do is we'll define, instead of talking about the spin models themselves, we'll define Hamiltonians that act as logic gates. So you have three spins, and you have a Hamiltonian that couples those three spins. Okay? And what I'm going to do is I'm going to force it so the ground state are all of the spin configurations that are in the truth table of the logical AND gate. Okay, so that's very easy to do for a three-body Hamiltonian. You have logical AND, 0 AND 0 is 0, etc. Okay, so you take one and you subtract that off, and what you do is you end up with a degenerate ground state with 4 and an excited state. Everything in the ground state is everything in that truth table. So your zero energy subspace are all the satisfying vectors.
Just a stupid question. Why delta?
Actually, that's a good question. Just delta for gap. No reason in particular besides that.
No relation to any operatorial delta function or something?
No, just because people use delta for the gap.
Ah.
Yeah. In spin language, I think,
okay,
sometimes.
Okay. Nothing scary.
No, it's not too scary. Is there any other comments about this or questions or remarks or anything else? Okay, so as we said, the ground state is given by all the satisfying assignments that are in the truth table. The excited state is not. Those get an energy penalty. Okay? Now, what do we do with it, right? Can we use this as a ground state gate? Can we make the spins compute something? And the answer is yes, but we have to do something more than what we've done. Because it doesn't really mean too much to just say that, oh, anytime you're in the ground state of the system, you're going to be in the truth table of AND. Well, that doesn't actually tell me what the AND, what's the AND of two values. It doesn't tell me that. So to do that, well, there's a few different things you can do. So the way that these came about, what we're thinking about, is taking the output of the gate and adding a penalty, then annealing your system, and then measuring the inputs of your gate. So if we added the penalty to project that ground state, so the only thing that is in the zero energy space are all of these satisfying assignments that give zero, then all of those would be the new ground state. So you have to add an energy penalty. So you can do it. So you start to reason about spins in this way. And all of these types of spins, all of these circuit elements that we talked about before, these classical circuit elements, now we can map them right over and they become Hamiltonian terms. And all of these can be composed. And you can hook them together, wire them together, and you can control precisely the type of ground state that you get. And all of them, of course, can be mapped, you know, using Boolean variables or spin variables. I just put some examples up there. The things that we're normally considering in physics are, you know, having a penalty that insists that two spins will be equal, or a penalty that will insist that they'll be not equal. And then you can end up with a large system with many of these different couplings, and it can become very difficult to model. So let's just imagine, for the sake of imagining, that you have some function, and let's say that it's a satisfiability question. So you're given this function, and you translate this into a bunch of gates, then you translate it into a bunch of Hamiltonians acting on spins. Then what you do is you'll add a penalty to the output spin. Okay, you'll clamp that to force it to be logical one. And then you're going to anneal your system, you'll measure the input spins. And those will give you, if there is a satisfying assignment, you'll get that. Otherwise, you'll get ones that violate the fewest numbers of clauses. And if you want to check out more about this, there's my, so I wrote a few things about this, actually. And all of these, of course, can just be written in terms of these spin Hamiltonians. Now, okay, so what's the message here? We have a compositional structure. We have a circuit model for Hamiltonians, but we're not really dealing with things that are really quantum. We're dealing with these spans, but they kind of behave. They behave a lot like quantum things. So we're dealing with, you know, we're adding circuit components, and it's projecting bits off, and it's changing what's in that ground state, as long as you do everything with the rules that we've talked about. And now we'll talk about quantum networks and see how those are very related to this. So quantum networks is just going right back to what we were talking about before with the Penrose notation. We have wires, cups, caps. You know, the quantum physics notation is probably, if you're working on quantum computing, you're probably more familiar with that. If you do this stuff for long enough, you'll start using just the tensor notation, the abstract index notation, which I personally prefer. And so then I use notation to get back and forth between them. But people, we have to do something, so. A lot of people will write their diagrams with vectors, with legs going down, covectors, legs going up. For the longest time I've been writing, I flip my circuits around, so I'll have this be a vector. And then I'll kind of have gates, you know, gate acting on it. So that would actually be u psi. Okay? But now I'm actually just going to do it the way that I've always wanted to do it. And I'm just going to start writing things just like they are in the equation. Okay, then when I want to make a measurement, I put something over here, for instance. And that would be a post-selected measurement, of course. Okay, so the Penrose duality was the bit that we talked about before, and this is the idea that you could take perhaps a density operator and you bend all the wires to one side, so that density operator gives rise to a quantum state. It also gives rise to a family of maps. You can start hooking these maps together and you can contract them as tensors. And so that's called Penrose duality. An example of that would be how you could take a sigma matrix and you could vectorize it, as they'd say in perhaps open systems language. You could bend a wire, and you could get, you know, one of the Bell states. So for that one, you get that out. That's that. It's defined like that. And we started with this. And this is the duality here. It's the Penrose duality. And it's invertible. So if I bend a wire, then bend it back, I'll be back to where I started. Okay, so we're connecting a part of quantum mechanics that is just the Boolean segment. So in order to do that, we have to define a class of states which are called Boolean quantum states. And Boolean quantum states are given by equally weighted superpositions that have coefficients only 0 or 1. Okay? And from that restriction, you can pull over a lot of tools from algebra and analysis for these types of functions. And you can actually say a bit about correlations and behavior in these types of states. And it becomes interesting in that regard. And the way that I look at this class of states, this is my next slide. So the way that I look at this class of states, this is kind of the glue that holds our tensor networks together. Okay, so in practice, most of what's going to happen in a tensor network algorithm is a computer is going to factor all these tensors, and they're going to reduce the degrees of freedom. They're going to use data compression techniques on it. Now, parts of those algorithms, or parts of it, at least for the conceptual understanding, could be given by Boolean tensors, and those are tensors that we have a lot of control over. So the idea is that instead of composing functions, you contract tensor networks. And to get this quantum state, you take the function f, you take the classical network, you turn all of those classical gates into tensors that are now given by these sums, you contract them up, you take this, instead of adding an energy penalty like we did with the ground state spin stuff, you project onto this one by contracting, and this will give you precisely that state. Okay, so this is the AND tensor. And under Penrose duality, I can start moving across to Ketz, etc. You can look at it and kind of think about what LaFont was doing with all those graphical rewrites. You can let these tensors act on different things. That's kind of the idea. So we're not dealing with spans anymore. We're dealing with linear sums. And so that's kind of the difference. And otherwise, it's very similar. Actually, everything kind of behaves about the same. And the mathematics at the highest level, the categorical level, is basically identical. There's only slight differences.
Sorry, what does you mean by linear? No, you are not working with linear.
Oh, I just mean that, yeah, I just, okay, so before the AND gate, instead of a plus here, it was given, the ground state was given by a span of anything in the satisfying assignment. So anything in the truth table. Now I sum over the truth table.
Okay, so it means you have sum with partition one? Is that,
yes.
Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. Okay. Yep. Exactly. So every single gate now becomes a tensor with these coefficients, whereas before every single gate was a logical function. And the ground, it is basically a difference that could be explored more to think about what would be the difference between quantum and classical. So classical maybe you think about as these, these Hamiltonian penalties, and quantum maybe you could think about as this, this Boolean world. And maybe we could think about entropy relations or something else and just start, start really saying, okay, the mathematics is the same, where does it differ, and how does entropy relations differ, and then maybe say something about, a bit more foundational. Okay, so why is it good to use classical gates? Well, we understand it pretty well. So the rewrite system, LaFont worked on this. We modified it, and we kind of switched things around a bit and let these act on a Hilbert space instead of these sets. And you get these rewrite rules, and these can be used to simplify things, to reason about things. And going forward, you also get this AND gate. And these won't be too relevant for today's discussion, but just to show where LaFont was. LaFont was in 1995, and then in 2002 he kind of refined things for this specific case, and then it's been refined over the generations and kind of presented in a very succinct way in this paper. Okay, so for instance, you can create a function which will give you 1 whenever you input the bit value in here. Okay? So it's only 1 on 3 values. Otherwise it's 0. Then you take and you write down that function, then you write it down, you decompose it using some dumb decomposition method, just a very poor one. Then you take and you contract it with a 1 here. And this actually gives you a tensor network for the W state. Okay, but here's where it starts to get more interesting. So that is not the only tensor network you get for the W state, because nobody said that you have to use these all as if they're classical gates. You can do just what you did in this Hamiltonian picture, and you can start flipping these things around. And I keep trying to motivate, I don't know very many computer scientists, but I keep saying, hey, nobody really understands the complexity. So there's a question for theorems by Shannon about this average complexity and all this stuff. Nobody really understands the complexity of networks where you can use the gates in both directions. So I think it's kind of an interesting question. So maybe some computer scientists at home that are really bored and they made it this far without throwing up will see this and tell me what exactly is going on. So it's quite interesting. In my opinion, you replace whatever's inside the function with a network of contracted tensors, and you go from there. So just to kind of go back to the comparison, so the point that some people were thinking about is the penalties change the span of the ground space. The tensor basically acts as a linear map, so they're quite related in some sense. All right, so application. All right, so tensor network algorithms, they work by contracting things. What you could do is you could take a network, tensor network for one function, tensor network for another, contract it, and you can evaluate that, and that'll give you the number of ones in your state. So that's like satisfiability. So if I have a SAT formula, I can translate that SAT formula into a network, and then I want to be able to estimate. We can actually do, so Tommy Johnson, he came up with a nice trick. He said instead of marrying it, contracting it like this, we put in a plus state, plus state, plus state, and just contract it that way. And he showed, he proved that was the same. So that's pretty good. So we're working on some ideas of that. And he has some other good ideas as well about how to do various different things. Now, so does anybody have any remarks about that or comments or anything? It's just a way of how to do satisfiability using tensor networks. Okay, so it is a bit of an academic exercise to do something like this, and I can explain to you why, because it's kind of the same reason why a quantum computer, if we had one, wouldn't be used for Grover search. Okay? SAT solvers are pretty good. And when I say pretty good, I'm talking millions and millions of variables. So in order to do numerics, like if we're going to say this is a good method, we'd have to go out and we'd have to do numerics and we'd have to show that. And that would take years of work. That would take a lifetime to compete with these things. And there's SAT competitions. Now, if you go and you look at condensed matter physics, nobody really has methods. You know, people have methods to solve SAT problems. There's no methods. There's no current methods. And the current method is this tensor network business. So that is something that people are researching, and that's different. So if we wanted to make an impact in SAT stability, classical SAT, it would be very, very time-consuming. But for theoretical purposes, this is interesting, and it also has a nice connection back to those skin models. So this is theory. This isn't going to help us land an airplane just yet or solve the constraint equation. But it is interesting nonetheless. And here, so there's a slide that is out of order, but I'll carry on with it nonetheless. This just shows that inside of these gates, you actually get an AND state if you like. Okay, so we were happy to find that. And you can also use these rules to do strange manipulations with quantum circuits. All right, so let's go back and we'll think about that. We'll think about that network we just had with this satisfability, and we'll think about what it means if that was a MARA network. So, just to draw it up here. Okay, so this is what we're talking about on this slide. We're talking about taking two of those Boolean tensor networks and contracting them. All right. So some time ago, Penrose proved in 1967, and he said that the norm of a tensor network vanishes if and only if the physical situation it represents is forbidden by the rules of quantum mechanics. Okay, so that's very interesting. He was doing something that wasn't really about the tensor networks that we're talking about. He's talking about spin networks. So the only thing I changed in his theorem was the word tensor network, which used to be spin network. But they're the same. And so what he was saying is, he's saying, hey, you have all these operations, and if it's impossible, the norm of that state is zero. Okay? And what we just said is we have this idea that if your if that function is satisfiable, it has a norm which is greater than zero. Okay, so all of the satisfiable states in this weak sense are physical states. Okay, so a read once formula is called read once only if you're not allowed to use a variable more than one time, which restricts you and says you're only allowed to have circuits which have fan out. There's no fan in. Okay, and then it follows immediately by thinking about Mera. That you can contract these, and all of them are necessarily satisfiable. Okay, because the gates will cancel themselves out, and you end up with the inner product of the ones. And so every read once formula is satisfiable. It's not a, it's just kind of a connection back. It's not a great result necessarily, it's not a profound result, but it's an interesting result in the sense that we can look at that class of networks and kind of compare it over to the quantum setting, which are these Mera networks. And thinking of this in terms of satisfiability, begs, at least for me, it begs the question, well, is there a way, is there a way to kind of define a new type of quantum satisfiability in terms of these networks? And then think about which which classes of networks would be quantum satisfiable.
Jacob, sorry, I need to ask you this. So I read that thing, connection to Mera, and I did not understand what you mean by the connection to Mera.
Okay.
Can you repeat that, please?
Yes. Okay. So here I will take some gate like this, and I'll pick the normalization such that this will happen.
Okay.
For all of them. And I'll take a function which is read once, which means the network will look like etc. Then when I contract it, so this contraction right here gives me the sum over f of x. Okay? Now if that sum is equal to zero for certain types of networks, this can vanish, but never for ones that are always look like these trees. Those will always be satisfied.
So that would be a tree, right?
Yeah.
And when you say Mera, you mean tree as well, or?
Yes. That's one thing that actually. So I consider Mera to be a class of algorithms that has one very specific property. And I hope that you agree with me, since you're the one that invented this. But I consider it to be basically. The trick that if you put something down here and you use this idea that things will cancel to get correlations, so you get your correlations out. So if I were to put more of a tensor network down here, I mirror it over, and this part will just kind of this will sort of vanish. And that's kind of the idea behind Mera. So it's a class of algorithms, and you have branching Mera and other types of Mera. So the classical version of it, you end up with these read once formulas. So we didn't know that when we first started doing it, and so it seemed. Seemed reasonably interesting, just because it was a connection back to the classical computer science.
But the property you're using is simply unitarity, right? You could have a quantum circuit, an arbitrary quantum circuit, but
yes.
You mirror back.
That is absolutely true.
Cancel.
That is absolutely true. Yeah. But in this case, it actually says something about the type of formula, because it says all of the SAT formulas that are read once are necessarily satisfiable. Okay. Now, to go past, this is an interesting point, right? To go past that, how do you go past that notion and think about satisfiability, quantum satisfiability in this? I don't know if it's a good question or a bad question, but I believe it's a question that these people, you know, I've talked to them about this, and it seems like it might be a way to do a little bit more. Okay, so going forward and kind of connecting this with some work with Vilay Bergholm. And basically, we looked at the category of quantum circuits and the category of matrix product states and stuff like that. We did various different things. I'm just kind of wrapping this up now. So I'm just kind of going to give an overview of sort of some of the stuff we've done. Let you just sort of reason about things in various different ways. Okay, so. In this other line of work, and like with every talk, you prepare and you think, I don't have enough material. I only have 60-some slides. I'm going to rip through those. But it seems like I have quite a few slides. So I'll probably just kind of skim through this a bit. And just I'm returning back now to what Penrose has done. And I'm looking at a way now to take, starting with what Penrose has done, factoring, revealing some internal structure. By the way, using this Penrose duality, this is a form of map state duality. So this is kind of a take-home little trick here. You have a state okay? And now I've done this right here. And now this is a state, okay? And then this is a map, okay? So you just think of those as two different things. So it's kind of a graphical version of map state duality. And this is desirable to factor a state in this fashion because this dot is well studied, it's well defined, and it can contract bits. You can contract it and do different things with it. And so looking at it this way, we take a state and we factor it. It's confluent in the sense that if I were to take a state on this side and one on this side and trace one out, I get back exactly what I'd expect, a product of Schmidt values. Okay. And in the bipartite case, the singular values are stored in here. The properties of the dot determine your entanglement topology, if you will. For one case, when there's only one singular value, it will break apart. For the case that all singular values are equal, it will become a bell stage to wire. And for other cases, you can't say too much, but you can look at the invariance and other contracted networks. This is how a matrix product state would look, just the exact same as a regular matrix product state, but now we're going to keep these to be our diagonal maps. And why would we do this? Well, we'll see in just a second. We started to contract tensor networks based on these invariants. Okay, so invariants are, if I take my quantum state and I write down a polynomial in the coefficients of the state, I want that polynomial to be an invariant under an action of a group. So the group acts on a state, that induces an action on the polynomial, and that polynomial will remain unchanged. There's a whole big theory around that. Marcus Rossel is a colleague of mine who's done a lot of early work on that, and he was looking at entanglement and other things. The theory of invariance dates back to Hilbert, Cayley, Sylvester, etc. And the reason why this factorization is interesting is because the invariant, you put it into a Penrose tensor network, you can contract it and just show how it relates to the singular values. And we've toyed around with that. We're looking at different ways to do that for various different scenarios. This is invariance of mixed states. So you can go through and you can generate a basis by thinking of tracing over the symmetric group, which are now given by these braids, with the density operator. And this, for instance, is showing that this is a unitarily invariant tensor contraction. So if your density operator undergoes a unitary evolution, you can see how those will cancel out. And actually, this whole thing will just go to rho squared. Likewise for this. And so the idea is that when you have invariance, you have a basis, okay? And it's called a Hilbert basis. So this isn't the Hilbert basis. The Hilbert basis is the fundamental invariance. And those are very hard to get. But any complete basis, you can express any unitary invariance. So for instance, the one that's very common right now, which Ann Kalin works on, is the Rennie entropy. Okay, so the entanglement spectrum. These are all unitary invariants. So if you have a complete basis, if you have a way to calculate them, just skip over that. You can do various different things. So this is the kind of stuff that I'm talking about now, and just trying to apply these ideas to measure, numerically measure, things that are interesting related to spin models, like taking a reduced density operator with half the system and estimating rank, or evaluating something else. Okay, so going outside the Boolean class of states, we have various different methods to factor quantum states in general. This is a generating set for stabilizer states. We've looked at that quite a bit. There's different ways to look at them. I'm doing that with Oscar Elstein. Okay, so Alex Parent at IQC, he's a student of Mikhail Mosta. We're talking about using these types of ideas for state preparation. Okay, so Chris Wood, also at IQC, this is a figure out of his final report for the course. And he did a master's thesis, I think with someone in the audience, on an open quantum system. So he's red hot with that theory. And he went through and he did what several people have talked about. He actually knows enough to do it. He goes through and he does it proper justice because he really understands open systems precisely, and he understands adaptation, and now he understands extension representation. So he's went through and he's casted this theory, and he says, okay, you know, here's the part of the theory that, you know, we can use all this wire bending stuff, here's this other stuff, and so we're working together on that. It's pretty excited. I'm pretty excited about it. It's going pretty well. Sam Denny looked at these 2D topological states, how to contract those, doing different things. That was really good stuff. Okay, so this one's a bit, this is a bit more fun. This is kind of my stuff, and I've talked about it with Lin Chin of CQT, who's actually going to come to UW at IQC now for a year. And it's the idea that you can equate a symmetric basis with a just a variable, polynomial variable. You can build yourself a Hilbert space that way, and then you can take all these symmetric states and look at them as polynomials, and you can start thinking, okay, how well do we understand the mathematical structure of symmetric polynomials? And you go back and you look at Sylvester's table here, and he says, okay, here's all the invariants. We got them. We can trust him. We trust him up to about here. And the covariance as well. And so this is going to get us up to 6 or 7 bits. It's ongoing work, but we should be able to understand precisely the entanglement structure, at least the symmetric sector, and kind of a new way in terms of these invariants. It's very hard to get these in general. It's a computational problem in general. So for four bits for the pure state, they don't have the unitary invariants yet, not all of them. So. Again, thanks to my collaborators. So it's been fun working on this stuff with them, and it's good to see just basically people with really good ideas. So the stuff's fun. And actually, I was thinking today, kind of this PI talk thing, where you know you come here, you give a talk, you can actually look back on your life and just you know watch yourself age and watch your research change or something. And so I look forward to coming back. And I figured this one is kind of an introduction, saying here's how we're setting everything up. Here's why we're motivated. Here's the three guys why I'm coming here to say hi. You know, how do we take what we're doing from this strange perspective? How do we, you know, this is like the quantum information perspective, and you have the condensed matter stuff. How do you hook this stuff together and create something really interesting? Okay, so this is just kind of the benchmark for species, right? So I want to end this just with kind of a discussion of what a benchmark for species would be. So a benchmark for species would be a day when we harness quantum mechanics in a way that outpowers the best classical computer algorithm. And here's how I think that this could work. You find something like a modest molecule like caffeine. Okay, and you'll find out that pharmaceutical companies would be very, very interested if you could tell them what the ground state energy of caffeine was by pressing a button. That means they don't have to do any experiments. They could modify caffeine and mess children up in many different ways. Okay, so that can't be done on a supercomputer. How can we attack it on a quantum computer? Well, you have the Hamiltonian, and there's theories now saying you can take that Hamiltonian and turn it into a gate sequence. But we already showed that that gate sequence, that algorithm, is just a tensor network. You can contract it. So the benchmark for species, the way that I see all this stuff going, is the existing approach to simulate physics and chemistry on a classical computer, it'll all be replaced. It'll become tensor contractions. Then we're going to actually understand which contractions are hard. And those are the ones that we're going to save for our quantum computer. So we could write down a circuit right now. It's going to have a lot of gates. Yeah? And we could say we need this many gates to simulate caffeine. And we could actually try to contract part of it on a classical computer and we'd fail. Right? So that's our benchmark for species, is basically using a quantum computer to be a tensor network contraction engine. And maybe it's something that we'll see happen. I don't know. The guys at IQC are, you know, everything, you know, the end of our lives, the middle of our lives, you know, a few more years, 5 years, 40 years, who knows, it's going to happen. So I think it's going to be interesting to find out. That's the end of the show.
All right. Thanks a lot. So I guess, are there any questions?
Everybody did so well asking questions during the talk. You don't have to feel obligated to ask one now, so.
Good.
Yeah, and I'll talk to some of the guys about some of the other stuff I'm doing right now, some stuff I'm working on later. I'll grab tea or something like that.
Dave Jenkins?
Yes.
when you were talking about satisfied identity and yes. fan-out networks. So, I mean, obviously there's fan-out, there's fan-in. And then there's things like ubiquity gates, which are neither fan-out nor fan-in. When we're talking about satisfied identity, you said that all fan-out circuits are satisfiable. But what about ones that are mixture of, am I correct in inferring that fan-out with unitary are also satisfiable from what you're saying? So in other words, the more that ones that not fan-in is a class of satisfiable ones.
Absolutely, yes. And it just happens, exactly what you're saying is precisely right, and it just happens that the classical restriction gives you the read-once formula precisely. So that is the, you know, and they don't look at it that way in classical computer science. So Mera basically shows that in a very evident way. So that's, yeah, precisely right. And I was going to actually ask, if you did ask a question, if you're able to ask it in French, because I think people that don't know, Rob just took it, it's very impressive, he took a test to get French citizenship points.
No.
Okay.
Well, I'm taking my French test towards my Canadian permanent residency, and that's Friday.
Okay, so it's not yet. If it was after the test, then we have to...
Any other question? No, let's thank Jacob again.